This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
At 503-901-5878 or by email to KURTLAUER at OregonRealty.com.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look this cold, wet winter morning. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin, your host. If you're living in the Portland area, you cannot have missed the ongoing trial of Mohammed Mohammed in the downtown federal courthouse. Mohammed is accused of being a terrorist who attempted to set off a bomb at Portland's Christmas tree lighting ceremony in 2010. The bomb was a phony provided by Mohammed's FBI handler, and no one was ever in danger. Only 17 when he was first approached by federal agents who then hand-walked him through the plot, Mohammed's attorneys call it a case of entrapment. Tune in. I want to remind everybody that KBOO's Evening News at 5 p.m. has been having live coverage by reporter Joe Meyer. So do tune in the evening at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday to stay up on what's happening in the courthouse. But this is only the most recent of high-profile cases alleging terrorism to be held here in Portland. From afar, you might think this rainy city we live in is just a hotbed of terrorist, conspiracy going on at any moment. There are foreign terrorists who are out to attack us. A more accurate picture of us is a post-9/11 Muslim community that finds itself subjected to constant scrutiny and selective intimidation and harassment by the federal government. To talk about the real situation faced by Muslims here in Oregon and who they are is Oregon attorney Tom Nelson. Over the past decade, Tom has been an attorney for many of those targeted by the government, including the Islamic charity Al-Haramain and Southern Oregon charity director Pete Seda. His client, Jonas Fikre, is a Portland resident who, while abroad, was jailed and tortured in the United Arab Emirates because he refused to become an informant for the FBI. He's still being denied reentrance to the United States, where he is a citizen. So most recently, Tom has also filed a lawsuit with his partner on behalf of Jamal Tarhouni, another businessman from Tigard, who was also put on the no-fly list and denied reentry for a period. Welcome to KBOO, Tom.
Really good to be here. Good to see you again.
Yeah. I don't think that when you started out as an attorney, this is what you thought your client list would look like.
I absolutely did not. It's just the events of the time brought me here.
Yep. Well, since the impression that gets put out there by the media and mostly by what the federal government says to the media and then their parroting of it is of a Muslim community that's harboring dangerous terrorists, I thought it'd be good to talk about who they really are. And I started to do some research on it. And funny enough, I didn't realize how hard that would be because, of course, there's no data collected on a religion as such, on the people of population in a certain area by religion. We don't keep data that way. So it's a little harder than you might think to find out how many Muslims actually live in the Portland area. But I did find a Pew Research study that came out in 2007 that covered the whole United States. It was a really good in-depth study, a survey that really wanted to find out who is the American Muslim and what are their beliefs and what are their thoughts. And in that, it turns out that there are approximately 2.5, probably more like 3 million Muslims in America today. This was in 2007. A full two-thirds of them are immigrants at some point, many of them from as far back as 1980s and then the 1990s as well. They don't come from any particular country. They come from 65 different countries. The highest percentage of any country is 8%, and two countries have that. I believe it's Iran and Pakistan. But the rest of them come from many other countries. About a third or 35% are native-born. And of the native-born, about two-thirds are African-American converts, which we've all seen throughout the nation. So any given location in the United States may have a concentration of people from one particular area or another, because people do tend to go where their family and friends are, and they say, come live here, it's a good place to live, etc. The other thing that it turns out is that they are very American. They're very American in the attitudes. The Pew Research is one of the best at studying what are attitudes, and it turns out that the majority of them don't see any conflict between their religion and living in a modern society. They chose to come to this country because of the things they like about this country. That's what drew them. Some came as refugees from areas of conflict, and that really is a minority of the overall population of Muslims. They also, by and large, don't support Al-Qaeda, and the overwhelming majority of adults, 1.5 million Americans that are Muslims, do not support extremism in any way. They found a slight disparity when they looked at the youth. When they looked at youth, they found that the youth were more likely to answer a question that was, would there ever be any justification for a suicide bombing? Overwhelmingly, adults said, no, never. But kids seem to have a little bit more sympathy, excuse me, and they did a lot of discussion on trying to say that, but I think it's just true that that's why we recruit young people into the military. They're more likely to get hot and angry and want to do something that way. But even then, they said when they showed support, it was only under certain circumstances. It wasn't like they believed anyone should do a suicide bomb here. It was if they put themselves in the place of someone who just had a relative killed by an American plane. Could you understand how that person then might put on a bomb and kill themselves and others? So even then, you didn't find attitudes of wanting to commit violence at all in the United States. So the picture that I got rounded out reminded me of actually the picture I kind of do see here in Portland. I'll see sort of wealthy-looking Muslims coming out of some high-end apartments in the Lloyd District, and then I'll just see students. And a lot of times, you don't know if Muslims are Muslims, so a lot of times I'm just identifying people by the woman wearing a headscarf. But Tom, talk to us about the community that you live in. You're a convert to Islam. You're a Muslim as well, and you've worked as an attorney for quite a while with the Muslim community. So talk about the community here in Portland and in this area.
Well, it's tremendously diverse. Beginning with the African American converts, they are now second and even third generation, coming initially from the Nation of Islam, and then like Malcolm X, they made the turn away from what I'll call a more parochial view into the mainstream Islam, which in the African American community is Sunni Islam, which is the largest sect. And they bring all of America with them. They bring the culture, the African American culture, the attitudes towards towards the nation, towards the family, how the family operates. A fairly strong matriarchal influence in the African American community because of necessity. So you have those people, and frankly, I enjoy worshiping with them because we really are part of the same culture. We're part of the American background. We know what our country looks like, how it works, how we got where we are in it. Then you have the immigrants. And the immigrants are the ones I know are again, Sunni and are either from North Africa, the Middle East, or East Asia, Pakistan, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. All of them predominantly Sunni, as I said. And there's one African-American mosque now. They're trying to start another one. And there are probably two or three Sunni mosques in the area, most in the southwest and the west. The major one, of course, is Masjid al-Sabr, which is the mosque down in southwest Portland. Then there's one over in Beaverton, Bilal Mosque. The southwest Portland mosque is predominantly from Middle East, and North Africa, Somalia, East Africa. And then the Bilal Mosque is more highly influenced by, I'll call it, Asian, Pakistani, further east. The educational qualifications of all the Muslims in the, all the immigrants is very high. They have responsible jobs. The immigrants tend to be more socially conservative. they bring their culture with them, which is normal. We saw that with the Germans and the Finns and the whoever that came to the United States at various times. But gradually, they become integrated. Their children become integrated. I think we're seeing that more and more. Then we have a different group. You mentioned the Iranians. The Iranians predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly are Shia Muslims. And that's a different, both a different organizational structure. Within the
way the religion is practiced.
Right, right. If the Sunni Muslims generally are somewhat unstructured. What a Sunni will do is he will have to, on his own, determine who he thinks is a good leader and why he thinks is a good leader, and then he'll follow that wise person or sheikh and put the majority of his beliefs back upon the Quran, of course, which is the fundamental document for all Muslims, and then the Sunnah, the Hadith, the practices of the Prophet, the sayings of the Prophet. The Shia, on the other hand, have, particularly in Iran and other countries, they have a very hierarchical society. They have a Ayatollah who basically will, in many ways, assume the role of the Pope, but also has a political, not just a spiritual presence. You see that in Iran, for example, right now. So it's a very diverse community. At the end of the day, for me anyway, a Muslim is simply somebody who says, I believe that there's one God and Muhammad was his prophet, and that's the end of it. Some people will say, no, you have to believe as I believe, as we see in Christianity. And, you know, unless you believe as I believe, you're not going to go to heaven. Unless you believe as I believe, you're going to be left behind. Unless you believe as I believe. My position my personal position, not that it really matters, is that anybody who makes this simple declaration of faith of the oneness of God and the leadership of the Prophet, it's over. And after that, whatever happens, happens.
But here in Portland, if you are, say you're an African American convert, and maybe you're second generation even, are you likely to go to a different mosque than the one you started out in? Do people who are already sort of established in one mosque stop at others very often or visit others, or is it pretty much like here? It seems like here many people join a church and stay with that church for many, many years. Sometimes, there's other things that change it, but...
Really, there is no membership in mosques. You don't have membership lists. I was a former member of the Unitarian Church, and I still consider myself a Unitarian in many ways. But no, there is no membership. If you go to any other country, the one obligatory communal activity during the week is Friday prayer, which occurs at noon on Friday. And that is always a question of predominantly which mosque is closest or most convenient. And you'll go and you'll hear a sermon. It'll be a short short prayer service, a sermon. Then you go on about your business. Geographically, the way it's broken down in Portland is, of course, in the Northeast, we have the African-American community, and we have the mosque up there, the Muslim Community Center. And you go in there during Friday prayers, and predominantly probably 90-95%, maybe 80% are African-Americans, and the others are immigrants from one place or another, all very dark skin. On the other hand, you go to the Masjid Asab, predominantly. There's a large Middle Eastern community near there, and so it's predominantly made up of Somalis and other folks from the Middle East. Then you go out to the east, go east from there toward the high-tech valley. Then you'll run into more and more high-tech workers who tend to be Indian, Pakistani, that sort of thing. It is not really a question of belonging to a particular mosque. In Saudi Arabia, where I go fairly often, and I go to the Friday prayer services, we go to a mosque that is known for its we think, intelligent sermons, but also very short sermons.
Very short sermons, so you can get that prayer done on time.
All right.
Now that sounds like some other people who might enter Mass and try to do it quickly, I wanted to say that one of the things that I found really interesting in the Pew poll was that 72% of those surveyed, and they worked really hard on the sample, a 1,000 to 1,200 people they interviewed. They originally started with 55,000 people, so they really worked hard at getting this. But over 72% believe the statement about the United States that if you work hard, you will get ahead. Now, that's even more than base Americans believe, in my opinion. They really do seem to believe in America, and they also become American citizens at much higher rate. For the populations that came here in the 90s, over 65% have become citizens. And for those that came as far back as the 80s, over 92% have become citizens. So there's a real desire. There is a self-selection process, it appears, to Muslims who are coming to the United States because they see something here they believe in and they want. Now, the attitudes of African-American Muslims about some of these same questions are different. They're much less likely to believe that you can get ahead if you work hard, for example. And I would say that would reflect the experience of African-Americans in this country, most of whose had to work very hard all of their lives and not gotten ahead along with the majority population at the same levels anyway. So I found it interesting that the same kind of disparities and divisions existed within the overall American Muslim population. The other things was that the youth tend to be more radical, and the Pew did a lot of work trying to figure this out, and in the end they really couldn't seem to figure it out. It had something to do with youth being more willing to accept violent and radical ideas, period. And I think that makes sense. That was certainly when I was my most willing to be violent, was in my adolescence. So here we have this population that really just wants to be part of America and be able to practice their religion and kind of live the American dream. And since 9/11, they haven't been allowed to go about doing that in the normal way. So I want you, the statistics show that overwhelmingly Muslims do believe that they're being unfairly targeted, and at least 40% of them do not believe that Arabs had anything to do with 9/11. That's the one big step away from mainstream culture that the average Muslim had, is they don't believe that it was necessarily Arabs at all. Now, they found those who had stronger foreign ties were more, even more disbelieving, and youth even believed less. They didn't, and to some degree, youth go to church more as well in Muslim communities, so they don't know if this has to do with their increased religious belief and fervor at that age or what. But I found that very interesting. So talk about how 9/11, because that's really what I wanted to get to, how since 9/11, this community that I hope I've laid out a little bit of a picture of for you in the audience, this community has been under assault.
Well, 9/11, of course, was probably the deepest psychological wound that America suffered since World War II, since Pearl Harbor. And created a lot of the feelings that we saw immediately after Pearl Harbor with the internment of the Japanese, that sort of thing. And as a matter of fact, the Japanese are strong supporters of Muslims because they've been through that. What happened after 9/11, I think, frankly, we had a two paths to take. We had a path to take whether we believe that this is an issue that should be handled by standard police practices, or whether we should declare a war on terror. And we chose the latter path and basically said, instead of going after individuals, we're going to broaden it to the entire community. There's something wrong with this community that leads to these kinds of actions, and therefore focus on the community. This, you can't back away from the idea that this was very convenient in some ways because of the problems in the Middle East right now between Israel, Palestine, and the rest of the Middle East. And you'll see a lot of funding even today coming from fairly strong Zionist forces against the Muslim community. And I'm talking about Pam Geller and her ads and the rest of
those. Those were the anti-Islamic ads that ran
right
inside streetcars and buses,
right,
and that kind of thing, and were very virulent.
Right. And so this is the path that America took, and we're going down that path. And I think, frankly, it was a terrible mistake. If you look at how Britain has handled similar events like their like the July subway bombing, they treat it like a police incident, and they work on it appropriately without trying to get their arms around an entire community and I don't know the right word, trying to intimidate the community and to make points. It's become very political in America.
And what's interesting is Britain actually has a higher percentage of their Muslim population who is sympathetic to extremist
right.
views, and yet they're being able to handle that situation without, I'm not saying Britain has handled it perfectly, please, I'm sure it has not. It is an imperialist nation, but still without having to, and in fact going against declaring a war on terrorism, this abstract thought, or on a certain people in general.
Right. No, I think the British made the right decision. They've been through a lot more than America has. We're insular. We haven't had these kinds of outrages on a regular basis. And then this one happened at just the time when everything was superheated in the Middle East and elsewhere. And the result being that now we've gone down this process of war on terror. We have enormous, how many, I can't even give you the number, but I think it's in the trillions, of war on terror expenditures. We have, we're basically, there's so much money out there, and there's so few terrorists out there in America, I'm talking domestically, that what has to happen is we go after all the marginal cases.
Well, and we now know that I believe that in 2000 there was something like 5,000 informants that were being used by the feds. We now know there are at least 15,000 regular informants being placed in, and an overwhelming majority of them, you're right, the money from Congress is specifically for this kind of terrorism, Islamic terrorism. It isn't utilized or sent to look at other forms of domestic terrorism. And so talk about the first case. It was not very, September, I think it was 2002, one of the imams.
In that case, Sheikh Mohammed was who's still the leader, the imam of the Masjid Asab, was going back to visit his family in the Middle East, and he was stopped at the airport. And the next thing he saw on the news was that they had found explosives residue on his luggage, and that was front page stuff.
It was front page all over the nation. Actually,
right,
that became
right.
this big national story of terrorists caught, and it was the head of one of the mosques.
Oh yeah, and it was, you know, the whole community was brought in. That here's your leader who's showing up at an airport with explosives in his suitcase was the way people would read that. Well, it turns out that it was a forensic mistake, like it was with Brandon Mayfield, the same issue. They made a mistake, but you once that bell is rung, and rung as loudly and as violently as it was, you can't unring it. So the entire population became stained by that story in 2002. The same thing happened to Brandon Mayfield in 2004.
Well, and in between that, there was the case of the Portland 7, a case I'm very familiar with because of Kent Ford, a personal friend of mine. His son, Patrice Lumumba Ford, is still in jail from that
right.
case. And that's the case of seven young men who the government says were planning to go to Afghanistan to fight against American forces. My understanding is at least Patrice wanted to go to Afghanistan to defend Afghanis he believed were going to be bombed and killed by American forces. They put informants in, they gave money, they gave weapons, they did all of this. They ended up having to force a plea agreement on these seven men because there was no evidence of an actual. Now they're more careful to take their plots a little further and make sure something gets made, but there was no anything to say that there was really going to be a violent act committed here in Portland. And yet, I don't know anyone who doesn't still believe that those were a bunch of really scary terrorists. I want to let you know that at least four of them are out and living in our population. Trevor Aronson, the author of the book Terror Factory, How the FBI Manufactured has manufactured terrorists, to be honest. In that, he makes it very clear that they don't need to have any real evidence. They will create the evidence.
They will create the evidence. They have it's since 9/11, an amazing thing happened. The zealotry of the FBI increased over and over and over again. And I think, frankly, it's an economic issue. The more press they get about how they're saving Americans from all kinds of bad things, whether they're made up or not, the more money they get. The more money they get, the more they're expected to produce. The more they're expected to produce, retain their current level, They keep going after it. We have seen a whole host of very weak fact issues in Portland that have been pursued in a manner that's just absolutely striking. I'll use the example of Pete Seda. For a number of months, there was everything in the Oregonian and other papers. A fellow by the name of Les Zeitz did a lot of the writing, saying Pete's a terrorist. He's associated with terrorism. The community suffered that for a number of years. Finally, it came to trial, and during the sentencing phase of the trial, Judge Hogan, who was certainly no liberal justice, said there is no link between Mr. Seda and terrorism. He said that flat out, and that whole premise of the Justice Department, of the FBI, evaporated. Nonetheless, that stain is still upon the entire Muslim community.
And the stain of the Aman is also there because they continue to attempt to get information about him. So let's come forward to some of the more recent cases. One of these cases is Jonas Fikre. Talk about him. He's a young man who it appears that the federal government targeted specifically to try to get him to become an informant.
He was overseas, and he was interviewed by a couple FBI agents, one from Portland, and was told basically, you're fine, you're not a terrorist, we know you're great, we want you to help us. Don't you love your family was one of the lines they used on him, indicating he has family here in Portland.
That's like a threat to your family if you hear it from a federal government.
That's the way he read it. And at the end of the day, he said, I'm not interested. He refused to meet a second time with the FBI. He went upon his merry way, whereas upon about a year later, he was arrested by Abu Dhabi police, put in their secret prison, and tortured for 106 days, always going back to the issues, what's going on in Portland. He wasn't arrested for anything he did in Abu Dhabi. He was never convicted of anything. Abu Dhabi said, there's no problem with you being here after you get 6 months past the time that we have detained you. You have to leave the country. So he wanted to come back to the United States, and so they went to get him a ticket. No charges. The guy's free. The guy's clean. But then the United States said, oh, by the way, you're on the no-fly list. You can't go home. What do you do? Well, he had some distant relatives that fortunately lived in Sweden. So he went. He said, well, that's the only country I know that isn't in the United States that I can go to.
So this young man's whole life has been turned upside down. He's been denied reentry to the country that he is a citizen of, all because they want to try to get someone who can come up with some evidence against this Iman. They've been working on it for a long time, if you think about this. You know, we're coming to the end of our time, and I wish I had had an hour. There are several more cases that are exactly like this. You just recently filed a lawsuit for Mr. Tarhouni, who was also held overseas. I want to thank you for coming on, Tom. We're going to have you on for a talk show, I've decided. I've just made that decision because we didn't get through everything I'd like to get through this time, and I occasionally get to substitute in on the talk show. So keep your ears open, audience. I will have Tom here again. You can always Google Tom Nelson and find the different cases. Also, I will link to information like that on our website. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom Nelson.
Linda, good seeing you again.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Just a couple minutes before 10 o'clock, and coming up later on at 10:15 on Flashpoints, a look at how 4.3 million Palestinians were prevented from voting in Israeli elections, and a report on a program to train teachers in El Salvador. At 11 on Bookwaves, Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Hummingbird's Daughter and Queen of America, discusses his two-volume novel about the life of his great-aunt, Teresa Urrea, known as the Joan of Arc of Mexico. At 11:30, John McAfee, yes, that John McAfee, is the guest on a special edition of Words and Pictures, along with local animator Chad Esley, who's been maintaining a whoismcafee.com blog. Listeners will hear tales of John and Chad's adventures in Belize, some never before discussed in either the print or the broadcast media. But up next, your host, Chris Andre. We'll take Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. And that is coming up next on KBOO.